From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Senator Ed Markey on net neutrality and the next elections.
If we win the Senate and the House in 2018, the dynamic, the momentum heading towards 2020 is going to be overwhelming.
Also today, Governor Charlie Baker keeps his high approval ratings in a new WBUR poll. But what about President Trump?
We compared the same questions we asked a year ago, and on pretty much every measure, people think that Trump's presidency has been even worse than they anticipated.
And Harvard professor Francis Fry on fixing Uber's corporate culture, even if change is difficult.
Harvard was born before the country, so I know it's hard to change Uber. I've been at Harvard, so I'm undaunted by changing anything.
Plus, how cancer patients navigate the sometimes complicated use of medical marijuana. That's all coming up on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey's effort to try to stop the repeal of net neutrality appears to be gaining support, even on the other side of the political aisle. Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins says she will support Markey's bill, which now has enough co-sponsors for a floor vote. Last month, the Federal Communications Commission voted along party lines to deregulate internet providers and remove Obama-era rules that require internet providers to treat all web traffic equally. We spoke with Markey a little earlier today while he was in Washington, D.C., and we began with how close he is to getting a vote on a net neutrality bill.
We need 30 members of the Senate to sign on as co-sponsors of the resolution, and we've passed that, and we're up to 44 now. Senator Collins from Maine has basically made it clear that she is going to be a supporter of the effort to repeal what the Federal Communications Commission did and to keep the net neutrality rules on the books.
Aside from Senator Collins, do you have other GOP senators ready to support the legislation?
Thus far, there are no other Republicans who have announced, but if every Democrat supports net neutrality plus Susan Collins, that puts us at 50, and we only have to get to 51. But it's pretty clear that momentum is building, that there is a phenomenal grassroots movement out there. Millennials are energized, and I'm increasingly becoming optimistic that this is turning from a technology issue into a political issue, and that members of the Senate are going to understand that there's a political price to pay if they do not support net neutrality, if they allow for those rules to be taken off the books. So I think as every day goes by, the momentum has built dramatically.
You know, even if it does pass the Senate, though, it's at least written that it would face an uphill battle in the House and a potential presidential veto. So, you know, why do this?
Well, I'm not so sure that it's a guarantee that it can't also succeed in the House of Representatives. 83% of all Americans support net neutrality. I do think that there's going to be an uprising across the country. I mean, 23 million Americans communicated with the FCC telling them not to change the net neutrality rules, and the FCC did it anyway. There's never been at any time at any agency in American history that kind of an outpouring of American voices on an individual issue. And here's the important thing. Last year, 50% of all venture capital in America went to web or internet-specific companies, meaning that the venture capital industry in the United States was saying, hey, these startups, these new companies, they can gain easy access to that national and international marketplace. Meanwhile, the big companies, the broadband companies, invested $87 billion in capital expenditures in 2015. So what you have is a nice balance. It's a sweet spot. Investment in broadband and wireless technologies is high. Job creation is high. Venture capital investment in online startups is high. It's perfect. It's a perfect balance.
So basically the system is working fine. Leave it alone.
It is a perfect sweet spot. And we in Massachusetts are especially vulnerable because our kind of entrepreneurial ecosystem is based around smaller internet startups being able to gain access in a non-discriminatory way to the web and get the product out there. And without net neutrality, they will never reach their audience, never reach their customers. And that's why it's such a huge issue for our economy in Massachusetts.
I want to ask you about immigration. The president appears now willing to maybe make some compromises if broader immigration reform is on the table. Are you surprised by that?
It's always hard to know what the president means when he is nodding his head or agreeing on something. So as we now discuss this issue with the president, we just have to make sure that he will write down and ensure that it is clear what the DACA, what the immigrant community gets, because he has now broadened it out to all 11 million people. And if that's the case, then that's a good discussion for us to have. But under no circumstances are the Democrats going to be voting for $18 billion for a wall when we know that it is drones.
Well, we should explain that a little bit, because that was a tweet from the president yesterday where he said our country needs the security of the wall on the southern border, which must be part of any DACA approval. What do you say to that? Do you think, is there any kind of compromise there where some funding for the president's wall proposal might have to be included if immigration reform were to go through?
Well, I think the Democrats are open to new technologies being used along the border. The president's already retreating from having a wall across the totality of the southern border, saying that technologies could be used in many areas, hundreds and hundreds of miles. So I think there's a new area here which is now open for discussion, and it is something that we are going to have to pursue very aggressively. But under no circumstances are the Democrats going to vote for the $18 billion for a wall.
Hmm. And finally, I want to ask you about the elections later this year. We have a new WBUR poll out today of Massachusetts voters, and that poll suggests 29% approve of the job that the president is doing. What do you think that means for congressional Democrats that are up for re-election here?
Well, I don't think that people in Massachusetts with a president at 29% favorability in Massachusetts are going to be wanting to send another Republican member of Congress down to Washington to give a vote for the policies of a president who is only viewed at 29% favorability. So that's not good news at all for Republicans in Massachusetts.
You know, on the state level, we've got a very popular Republican governor here in Charlie Baker. Three quarters of the respondents in this poll approve of the job that he's doing, and more than 60% of the respondents could not identify any of the Democratic challengers. Bob Massey, Seti Warren, Jay Gonzalez, all saying that they're going to challenge Governor Baker. I mean, so what do you make of that split there?
I think, on the one hand, the Democratic Party has yet to select a candidate, and so we have three good candidates who are out there and whose name recognition is going to rise as each week and month goes by, and they will become very well known before we hit Election Day. So we just turn the corner, and it's a week after New Year's Day, so that's very early in this process. But ultimately, I think what it says is that the Democratic Party has work to do.
How would you rate Governor Baker's job performance so far?
Well, you know, I work with him on opioids, and I work with him on even a couple of years ago when we had those huge snowstorms. I went into the White House with him to get that massive amount of money that came up to Massachusetts in order to help with the snow removal budgets. So I on many issues, I'm able to work with him.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you this, probably our last question here, about Oprah and the chatter about a possible 2020 run for president. What do you make of that, of a potential Oprah run for president?
My view of Oprah running for president is that there is clearly now a new era where people want desperately to almost select our nominee now for 2020. This is as you're just asking me to speculate on 2018 elections with a degree of uncertainty that still exists in 2018, much less jumping all the way to 2020. So I think there's a certain kind of desire on the part of people just to be able to sit around and speculate about 2020. But it first begins with Oprah deciding that she wants to run. And so it does mean that to some extent the rules are changing, and people, because of Donald Trump being a television personality, that people can look at other people who aren't part of the traditional political firmament and begin to, you know, speculate as to their viability as candidates. In past years, Ed Muskie was unbeatable as a Democrat this far out in 1970 for the 72 election. Mario Cuomo, the Mario scenario, he was unbeatable in 1990. No one even heard of Bill Clinton. You know, at this point, Barack Obama had just was 1 year in as a United States Senator, and Hillary could not be beaten. So it's fun to talk about, but sometimes it just can become speculation on steroids when the focus should be on the 2018 election cycle. It should be on the razor blade sharp issues, you know, on the Affordable Care Act, on climate, on energy, on net neutrality, on a giveaway of $1.5 trillion in tax breaks to the wealthiest corporations and individuals in our country. That is what we first have to put up on the agenda for the American people to decide. And if we're victorious, if we win the Senate and the House in 2018, the dynamic, the momentum heading towards 2020 is going to be overwhelming.
And now I know it's early, but you think that's likely?
I think it's very possible. When a president's at 29% favorability in Massachusetts, probably means he's not over 40 in favorability in most of the states in the union where we have to win the seats to take over the majority.
All right. Well, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, thanks so much for being with us today.
No, thank you for having me.
We want to talk a bit more now about that new WBUR poll that, among other things, finds Governor Charlie Baker continuing to enjoy incredibly high approval ratings. Joining us is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Deb.
So before we get to the poll, you were listening along to our conversation with Senator Markey. What struck you about what he said regarding the current state of the political landscape?
Well, so we're about to spend a few minutes talking about a poll and hearing Markey talk about, speculation on steroids. It just reminds us that before we have this conversation, Deb, any poll is just a snapshot of the current moment. They're not necessarily predictive. So when we talk about Charlie Baker's high poll numbers, we're not saying, therefore, we know he will be reelected next November. I mean, things look pretty good for Baker, let's be clear. But all we're really saying is that at this moment, 11 months out from Election Day, these numbers reflect a particular mood and feeling in the Commonwealth. But take them with a grain of salt. This is a poll of 500 people across the Commonwealth.
Okay. So with that in mind, though, let's talk about the Governor Baker numbers in the poll. He's we should say the governor has had impressively high ratings from the minute he took office. So this poll is suggesting that those high approval numbers continue.
No, absolutely. Yes. I mean, the WBUR poll shows that, you know, Charlie Baker has had and continues to have the kind of approval ratings that most politicians can only dream of. 74%, that is, you know, just about three quarters of the folks we polled, approve of the way he's doing his job. Only 13% disapprove. And what's striking about this is, you know, these are honeymoon numbers. This is what Steve Cazella, our pollster, said. These are honeymoon numbers. Most politicians elected to office get a break in the first month, 2 months, 3 months, maybe even the first year. But they can expect numbers like these to come down. But 3 years in, three quarters of Massachusetts voters approve of the job he's doing. They're really spectacular numbers. He's clearly the most popular politician in the state, and it has been said, and it's probably true, probably the most popular governor in the country.
Mm. So does the WBUR poll offer any clues about why Baker remains so popular?
Yeah, there are clues as to why. There's several reasons. I mean, specifically, the poll asked if you approve of the way Charlie Baker is handling the situation with the MBTA. Now, you remember when he became governor right after that winter of 2015, the MBTA was a mess. We had the winter from hell. The trains didn't run on time. The signals froze, on and on and on. So he redesigned the way the MBTA is run. He put in a new fiscal management board. He did $100 million in investment in winterization and a whole lot of other things. So 45% approve of that job, 19% disapprove, and 45% say that Baker has made the MBTA better. So he's a guy who gets things done. But I think even more important, he offers this strong appeal across party lines. I mean, in a state where Democrats outnumber Republicans 3-1, to get numbers like these, Baker is clearly getting lots of support from Republicans and independents, as well as from Democrats who just really like him. So I was in Groton a couple of nights ago talking to some voters. Here's Eleanor Jones, a Democrat from Groton, talking about Charlie Baker.
He's there for everybody, you know, and he's trying to get, you know, with the opioid problem and everything. He's trying his best. I think he's a good guy. I think he's going to be around for quite some time.
So can I assume you voted for him the first time?
Yeah.
And you'd probably vote for him again, right?
I will.
Mm-hmm. I will. So, and Deb, one other thing I'd say about Baker's popularity, I'd say that he's benefiting from being a pretty cautious politician. He works well across party lines. He's avoided big sweeping proposals on taxes or health care or big spending projects on public transportation that might incite pushback to his agenda. So I think that's part of the appeal as well.
And what did the poll say about Baker's Democratic opponents? Jay Gonzalez, Seti Warren, Bob Massey. What do voters think of the potential Democratic candidates?
So the short answer is they don't think much about them. They have a lot of catching up to do. And basically, these three folks are invisible at this point. Mm. If Baker is riding a wave of popularity, Warren, Massey, and Gonzalez are struggling to get their heads above water. So here are some key numbers from the poll. 65% say they've never heard of Bob Massey. 68% say they've never heard of Seti Warren. And 72% say they've never heard of Jay Gonzalez.
Yeah.
So there's a huge number of people out there who have never heard of these three challengers to Charlie Baker. Now, in fairness, as we mentioned a moment ago, we're 11 months away from Election Day, and people are simply not tuning in yet. But Steve Cazella, president of the Massinc Polling Group, which did our poll, compared these numbers to some past elections at the same point on the calendar. Here's a bit of what he said.
Over the last couple of election cycles and the WBUR polling we've done, and at this point in Elizabeth Warren's election cycle, you know, she was known by almost 70% of voters.
So Elizabeth Warren was very well known at this point. Before he won election, almost 50% of voters knew who Charlie Baker was at this point on the calendar. But today, a big majorities of Massachusetts voters don't have any idea of who the Democratic challengers are yet.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren. She's facing re-election next November. Tell us what the poll found out regarding her support.
Okay, so these are some numbers that we're just releasing today. 54% view her favorably. 38% view her unfavorably. So 11 months out, those numbers might suggest some vulnerabilities for her. I mean, she's got a 38% of voters who view her negatively. The problem for her challengers right now is the same one facing Democrats running against Baker. They're basically unknown. They're invisible. 80% of voters have never heard of Jeff Deal or Beth Lindstrom, two folks who are running against Elizabeth Warren. 82% have never heard of John Kingston. 85% never heard of Shiva Ayyadurai. So again, still early. But not that early. But, you know, but they're basically unknown. That's a problem for them.
Mm-hmm. The WBUR poll, as we mentioned, also looked at how Massachusetts voters view President Trump. And in a state that voted against him by a margin of 2-1, it's not exactly a huge surprise that he is unpopular still.
Right. Not exactly a huge news flash here. Donald Trump, not popular in Massachusetts. But it's an interesting contrast with Baker. You know, Baker's positive numbers have remained remarkably durable. The same can be said of Trump's negative numbers. 65% of Massachusetts voters, according to our poll, disapprove of the job he's doing in the White House. 29% approve. A majority think that he's been bad for the country overall. A majority think that he's damaged relationships with other countries. A majority think that he's hurt the environment and worsened race relations across the country. And pollster Steve Cazella says what's interesting about these numbers is how they compare to a WBUR poll we did on these same issues, these same questions a year ago.
We compared the same questions we asked a year ago, and on pretty much every measure, people think that Trump's presidency has been even worse than they anticipated.
But what about the economy, Anthony, which, you know, is touted by the White House? It says, you know, things are moving along pretty well, unemployment down, stock market up.
Right. And this is the one somewhat positive number for Trump. A plurality of the folks that we surveyed, 43%, say that President Trump has been good for the overall economy. And don't forget, a million people voted for Trump in this state. And so we reached out to Kurt Richard of Millbury, who responded to our poll. He says he supports everything the president has done, from appointing Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court to signing the Republican tax bill into law. And he gives Trump credit for fueling the economy.
I mean, the economy is booming, wouldn't you say? My 401k for the year is up probably 25,000. And I think a good economy benefits everyone from the lower class all the way up to the upper class.
But Deb, it has to be said, according to our poll, that's a minority view in this state. When it comes to the Republican tax overhaul, a majority of Bay State voters oppose it. And across the board, most think that the new law will disproportionately help the rich. A couple of other statistics. When it comes to the president's use of Twitter, 80% say Trump's use of Twitter is inappropriate. And when we ask, do you think Donald Trump is fit to be president or not? One-third of those surveyed said yes. Almost two-thirds, 62%, said no. So in a state that voted 2-1 against him, voter attitudes seem pretty stuck right where they were prior to November 2016.
All right. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks so much for coming in.
It's my pleasure, Deb.
And you can read the full summary of the poll and see all the numbers at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Harvard Business School professor Francis Fry on reforming the company culture at Uber. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, to put it mildly, Uber had a rough 2017. The founder and CEO of the ride-hailing company was forced to resign. There were numerous allegations of sexual harassment. And then came the news that Uber had a data breach that involved millions of people's personal information, and the company had kept that a secret. So, in June, Uber hired Harvard Business School academic Francis Fry to try to help fix its corporate culture. And Fry herself calls the situation a, quote, hot mess. Asma Khalid leads Bostonomics, WBUR's business and innovation team, and she recently caught up with Fry to talk about this. Hi there, Asma.
Hey, Deb.
So why did Francis Fry want this job at Uber? It doesn't seem like that's an easy one.
No, and Deb, she admits that this is hard. I mean, a part of it is, she told me, just logistically difficult. She commutes every week between Cambridge and California because her family still lives here in Massachusetts. But she told me that she really likes surfacing problems. She likes fixing cultures. And she's actually a big believer that essentially every single company doesn't have static culture, that it's always flexible and moving. And so no place in her mind is really theoretically beyond repair. I mean, this is kind of her thing. She's built a career off of changing organizational behavior. She was, in fact, an operations professor at Harvard.
And what was the environment like at Uber when she started there in June?
So the company was kind of the pariah of Silicon Valley. Let me have Frances Fry explain.
I would say that the morale was low. Here was my evidence of it, that I heard from many, many people that if they got into a car that was being driven by an Uber driver, they wouldn't admit that they worked for Uber.
Ouch.
Right? You just don't even want to say. And so she told me she's done something kind of small. She started wearing an Uber t-shirt every day around the office, and she just wanted to inspire people to essentially feel proud enough of the company that they don't feel like they're ashamed and need to hide this. And, you know, Deb, I want to be clear, right? Like, a lot of people will make moral judgments, I think, about the business concept of Uber itself, you know, that they make a profit off of drivers who are not necessarily their employees. But Frances's job is not really about that aspect of Uber. She's just much more in the business of going into a company and cleaning out their culture, really opening up their closets and trying to figure out what secrets were hidden there and how you can essentially fix some of those problems.
Mm-hmm. And how is she trying to do that and counter this reputation that Uber does have of sort of, I guess, in a nutshell, trying to bypass regulations?
Yep. And you know, she, in fact, did tell me that there were some folks, she said, at the company who made decisions of that sort. In her mind, a lot of those people are no longer at the company. And so she partly thinks that, you know, that it gives, I guess, the company the freedom to kind of move on in a different direction. She told me that she came up with three really major recommendations that she believes will dramatically change the culture. So, number one, she wants the senior team to work like a team. It sounds like a kind of minor, maybe, improvement, but she said that the way things were working before is that essentially each individual kind of manager had a one-on-one relationship with the former CEO. And that might be great for speed, for getting things done really quickly, but it was not good for quality. You essentially had a lot of do-overs. So she just wants essentially the senior team to work in cooperation, not to have silos. Recommendation number two is that she wants to train effective managers. She told me that Uber asked for the staff to send them emails about the company's culture, and this is what they realized.
There were, I think, more than 3,000 emails that were collected from people who were asked to comment on the culture. Every one of those that was negative, and it was quite a lot of them, almost every one of them had to do with an interaction with their manager.
Wow.
Almost every negative email involved a manager interaction. And she says part of this is that the company just had undertrained managers.
Really severely undertrained managers. These folks had been promoted at such a fast rate because of the unprecedented growth, and they weren't hiring from the outside. So you'd get put into a place of manager for the first time, and then before you know it, you're managing managers. And then you're managing managers, manager. I mean, just put out of your depth.
And, you know, part of this is what happens, right, when you have this hyper growth in a company like Uber had. And she thinks it is fixable, but they're not there yet. I mean, she told me part of what makes it difficult is Uber is just such a large company. They have 15,000 employees, and among those 15,000 are 3,000 managers. Mm. So, Deb, just real quick, the last recommendation she has is that she wants to clarify the strategy of a company. She said that the former CEO had all this strategy in his head, but not everybody knew what it was. And so as a result, you had all these folks kind of beating to a slightly different strategic drummer. She's hoping that the company can kind of develop its long-term strategy in 2018. That's the goal.
An ambitious goal. All ambitious goals.
It is. It is. And Deb, you know, Frances is confident that she can change the culture at Uber. And in part, she says she's done this thing before working at Harvard.
Harvard was born before the country. So I know it's hard to change Uber. I've been at Harvard. So I'm undaunted by changing anything.
Like a legacy institution.
Oh, my gosh. There's no more legacy than here. And I've worked with older institutions in other countries. But here's what I know. You need a super-duper careful diagnosis that sheds all of your own internal biases. And if we can get to a diagnosis, I know we can get a prescription.
And so, Deb, you know, she says that there are always going to be skeptics, and there were skeptics when she tried to change the culture at Harvard Business School.
And what did she exactly do at Harvard, Asma?
So, you know, Deb, for years, Harvard Business School had seen a gender gap both among its students and its faculty.
So I think that we had a longstanding acceptance that there was an achievement gap and a satisfaction gap between men and women. men had higher grades and men had higher self-reported satisfaction. And I think people, it had existed for so long that I think folks just had come to accept the rationales.
But Deb, she told me that she was not convinced that this was necessarily a permanent situation, right, where a bunch of the students sort of felt like they were academically not achieving as much, nor were they as satisfied with the program. And she was actually in charge of the required curriculum. So she joined with some other HBS administrators, and they went about, you know, essentially making these systematic changes, changes that she says meant that within essentially 1 year, all the gender gaps among students had dissolved. Then they started to focus on the faculty, and that, you know, has not been as easy. The most recent statistics show that of all HBS faculty, 199 are men, 67 are women. So still quite a gap there. And she told me that women were not climbing the ranks as quickly as often as their male counterparts were.
Women weren't being promoted as fast as men. So then you have to ask yourself a really hard truth. Are we making biased decisions, or are men more prepared than women? I think one of the unique ways I come after this is I am undaunted by either answer. It doesn't bother me which answer it is, because I know how to solve either.
So what was the problem?
Yeah. So she told me a lot of people assume that disparity is because of bias, right? It's kind of uncomfortable to sometimes think that maybe women are not as prepared. And so, you know, you'll see it a lot of companies. They have this unconscious bias training. And she's like, is it necessarily helpful if that's not the problem? Long story short, what they discovered at HBS is that it actually appeared women were less prepared.
Men were, on average, getting higher teaching ratings than women. You look at what was
By the students.
So then you're like, holy cow, are the students making biased decisions? Yeah. Double click on that, double click, double click. It turns out if a woman came to HBS and taught well, she remained teaching well. Same for a man. If a man came in the beginning and struggled, he got better. If a woman came in and struggled, not as likely she'd get better. So now we've pinpointed where the problem is.
And Deb, then they said they realized that the way they were trying to fix the problem wasn't good either. So the standard way is that they would make professors watch videos of themselves teaching. They realized that this was not helping the women at all. So administrators decided instead of making women watch these videos, they would give the women kind of a quick debrief, you know, essentially a coaching session. This is what went well. This is what didn't went well. And long story short, she says that through these coaching sessions, women, at least for now, seem to be improving as this at the same rate as men.
So these lessons that Frances Fry learned at HBS, have they then helped her at Uber?
In theory, that's what she's hoping for. I mean, in some ways, she did try this huge gender makeover at HBS. I think Uber is a really large organization, right, with a lot of disparate parts. But she's trying, she told me, to take over one key lesson, which is the idea that culture should not and cannot be homogenous, and that's a kind of dangerous way of thinking. She told me that one really important aspect of culture in her mind is diversity, and not just diversity in this buzzword sense of a view.
Just having diverse people usually lets us, you know, feel like it's victory, and it's not. We have to explicitly manage for the inclusivity. I think that by being inclusive of the diversity, not looking for how are women, men and women the same, but it's how are they different, and it's having the courage to treat people differently, and where they are different and where they need their difference to be celebrated. That's the key to all of this.
So, Deb, the example she gave me is that on the second day of her job at HBS, when she was in administration, she changed the maternity leave policy. And she said to me that this was something she had been hearing about for years from people, that they would either wait until they got tenure to become pregnant, or it was just sort of a big hiccup in the process. To her, that was a simple way of recognizing that there are differences, and maybe as a workplace culture, we should acknowledge that. And she said that's the kind of lesson she wants to take over to Uber. And she said it's really not wise to think that there's the HBS way of doing things or the Uber way of doing things. If there is, she says the company's in trouble.
Okay. Asma Khalid, she leads Bostonomics, WBUR's business and innovation team. Asma, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Well, medical marijuana has been legal in Massachusetts for 6 years, but cancer patients seeking to use the drug for relief still receive little, if any, guidance from their doctors about using medicinal marijuana. Patients say it can be a challenge to get a state-issued medical marijuana ID card, and they say there's little help in figuring out how they should use the drug. WBUR correspondent Karen Weintraub reports on how cancer patients navigate the complexities of medical marijuana use in Massachusetts.
Chemotherapy left Kate Murphy feeling terrible.
They give you pills that'll help take some of the nausea away, but for the most part, I felt nauseous 24/7.
After losing 15 pounds from her already slim frame, she remembered what a fellow cancer patient had told her while she was waiting for her first dose of chemotherapy. Make sure you get some medical marijuana. Scientific research supports the idea that cannabis can treat the nausea of cancer therapy, in addition to some types of cancer-related pain. But only about 1% of the doctors in Massachusetts hold a license to prescribe it. And there hasn't been much interest among cancer care providers in cannabis. Last June, the Massachusetts Medical Society approved a new online curriculum on medical marijuana. 6 months later, only 27 medical professionals had taken the section on cancer care and cannabis. For Kate Murphy, a 50-year-old mother of three from Lexington with stage 2 breast cancer, it was a struggle to find someone to help her navigate the medical marijuana system.
In terms of figuring out what to get and what kind of marijuana there is, there's more to it than you can ever imagine.
Murphy asked her oncologist at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge if it was okay for her to use marijuana. The doctor didn't say no, but didn't offer any further advice. And Murphy says she got no help from patient advocates or nurses either.
They said, yes, you can look into it, but I felt sad because you're so lost and you're so sick, and this is so not your area of expertise, that it was very upsetting to me to not get direction one way or the other.
Murphy ended up getting advice from Dr. Jordan Tischler. Tischler owns and operates InhaleMD, two Boston-area medical marijuana clinics. He says he has cancer patients referred to him by the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Mass General Cancer Center. Both Dana-Farber and Mass General told WBUR they had no experts on staff to speak with us. Tischler explains that medical centers, particularly those that take federal funding, are in a tight spot because federal law still classifies cannabis as an illegal drug.
Most of those institutions are prohibited and or afraid of the prohibitions from the federal government, and so have opted not to pursue this within their domain.
Last week, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions threw another wrench into the system by deciding to resume enforcing federal laws against marijuana, even in states where it's now legal. It's not clear yet what, if anything, that will do to Massachusetts' medical marijuana system. Here in the Commonwealth, state-licensed medical marijuana dispensaries are the intermediaries between doctors and patients. Dispensaries offer a huge range of cannabis products, from vaporizers to gummies, at various doses and strengths. But Tischler warns his cancer patients against getting advice on cannabis, either from the internet, which he says is loaded with misinformation, or from the counter folks at the dispensaries, who are not allowed under state law to give medical advice.
Fundamentally, they're salespeople. Their level of training, I often say, is about the level of a Starbucks barista. So I tell patients, look, if you wouldn't ask your coffee guy about your health, probably you shouldn't ask these guys either.
The good news, Tischler says, is that cannabis is generally very safe. He recommends that cancer patients buy their marijuana from a dispensary because the state's inspections ensure a safe, consistent product. The worst side effect for most patients, he says, is an unwanted feeling of getting high when they've taken too much. Norton Arbelez is director of government affairs for New England Treatment Access, which grows and dispenses medical marijuana. At the Netta Dispensary in Brookline, housed in an old bank building, Arbelez says his staff's goal is to educate patients, in part by offering anecdotes from previous patients' experiences.
We're not here to give medical advice. We're here to educate people about our products, and certainly the information that the physician gives is paramount. What we can say is we have heard from other patients that a particular modality, such as a vaporized or a topical or a pill form, has helped this particular type of condition.
And Arbelez says that medical marijuana's relative safety means patients can afford to be a little imprecise about the kind of marijuana they use and how much they get.
there is some room here for the patient themselves to experiment and to see what works particularly for them.
In the end, that's what Kate Murphy did, experiment. She tried a few joints and smoked a few times with a pipe. She spent a total of $700, none of it covered by insurance, including Dr. Tischler's out-of-pocket fee, a $50 state license, and the cost of the cannabis. But Murphy says just a few months of occasional smoking made a big difference.
For the first time in probably, 6 months, so I could eat. My husband remembers he came home and I was like actually up instead of lying around thinking about how sick I felt all the time. But I was up and cooking, which was not anything that, that I had done since I hadn't felt well.
Murphy stopped smoking when her chemo ended a year and a half ago. She's now cancer-free. She says she wishes patients didn't have to work so hard to get the information they need about medical marijuana. And she has no regrets about having used it herself.
That's WBUR contributor Karen Weintraub. Her piece is part of WBUR's series, This Moment in Cancer. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, North Korea will participate in the Winter Olympics in South Korea next month. And while the North isn't expected to win any medals, the South hopes that the move will help improve relations between the two countries. Joining us to discuss that and some other sports news of the week is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Deb.
So what do you think about this announcement that North Korea is participating in the Winter Olympics?
I think it's much better for people to talk than to not talk and to only glare at each other across the demilitarized zone which separates their two nations.
Right. But surprising at all? Like using the Olympics for diplomacy?
I think it's surprising that they managed to create any sort of circumstance under which they can talk to each other, because apparently that hasn't happened in a couple of years. Not entirely surprising that sports is involved. We can go all the way back to ping pong diplomacy during, I believe, the Nixon administration between the U.S. and China. It sometimes is a way to, get something started, and so we can hope for the best, I think. And I'm very encouraged that the North Koreans are sending cheerleaders, because who knew that there were cheerleaders in North Korea?
Right. But do you think, given, history and the players involved here, that we might actually see any kind of political movement or improved relations?
All I can say is it can't get worse. You've got, President Trump calling the North Korean leader by silly names and all sorts of stuff that can't get any worse than that. So, I hope it will get better. And the whole point of the Olympics, at least at the outset when the games were reconstituted in the modern Olympics, was that people should be able to talk to each other, compete against each other in a friendly way, and shake each other's hands and get to know each other a little better. So perhaps there will be some of that going on.
And as for the U.S., Vice President Pence, right, going to the Winter Games in South Korea, do you think, how does what's happening with high-level U.S. officials affect any ideas? Yeah.
No, I gave up some time ago trying to predict what high-level U.S. officials would do or say, because they so often say something completely contradictory within 15 minutes.
Especially now. Let's turn to the Patriots, because that's been the big news of the past week, really. They play the Tennessee Titans, of course, Saturday night.
Right.
A recent ESPN report, though, came out just a couple of days ago alleging that there's a big rift, really, between Coach Bill Belichick, owner Bob Kraft, and quarterback Tom Brady. Now, everybody involved denies, right, any rift. So let's listen to a clip of Tom Brady's response to the report.
I think you can go about your life and certainly here with this team, and try to do, what I've always done for a long time, and then be a good teammate and work as hard as I can to help the team win. And then, somebody could write something to contradict that. And I think it's up to everybody to believe whatever they want to believe.
So essentially, what can I do? People believe it. what do you think of this report and the report of the riffs here?
The Beatles broke up. You can have a tremendously successful operation organization be making lots of money and producing lots of wins, whether it's hit records or football games. And sometimes egos get in the way. And in this case, I think there is probably some truth to the fact that egos get in the way with the Patriots. You're talking about three people who have enormous egos and who have all been tremendously successful in their respective fields. So it wouldn't surprise me. And Brady's, you know, sort of sideline of health foods and I'm going to play quarterback until I'm 45 and I'll never get injured because of these marvelous things that I do and eat and drink. It would be disruptive, I would think, in any context. So, yeah, there's probably some truth to it. The question is whether they can get beyond it and play great football anyway.
Right, right. Well, so there are those reports about Tom Brady and his business partner and body coach, right, Alex Guerrero, right, and as being a source of tension here. And what does all of that mean? And then there's also the Garoppolo report, right, and what happened there with the trade. The ESPN report says that Brady and Kraft pushed Belichick to trade Jimmy Garoppolo earlier this season. Now we're a few months away from that. Was it smart for the Patriots to trade Garoppolo?
Well, Jimmy Garoppolo made it look stupid because he went to San Francisco and played great.
Right.
So, you know, really sort of revitalized the 49ers at least for a brief time. So it looks as if, holy cow, how come they let that guy go? He looks like he could play quarterback in the NFL in case, you know, Tom Brady wakes up with a stiff neck some morning. But it could have happened either way. And if Brady continues to be healthy, everybody's going to forget this controversy, assuming he's healthy through the playoffs and the Patriots are successful in the postseason, which most people expect them to be. This is going to blow away.
Hmm. How do you think Brady has been doing, though, overall?
Well, he's been doing well enough so that a lot of people are talking about him as a serious candidate for most valuable player in the NFL, and you can't do too much better than that.
If we go back for a minute to the Alex Guerrero, you know, Brady's body coach and business partner, as that story, there is a documentary coming out that goes behind the scenes of Brady's life. It's titled Tom Versus Time, and it's about his relationship with his family and his lifestyle, and this documentary is set to be released, you know, later this month. What do you make of this project?
I don't understand why somebody who has been so successful in his chosen field of endeavor, which is being the quarterback of an extraordinary National Football League team, should feel that it's necessary to also market his lifestyle in the service of selling product. But maybe that's just me. I think it's ridiculous. But again, I suppose in this wonderful world of unlimited opportunity for the wealthy, he can do whatever he likes.
Well, okay. Well, let's talk about the team, right, and where we are in terms of the playoffs. We've got the game Saturday with the Tennessee Titans at Foxborough. A lot of excitement about this game. What do you think? What do you think we're going? Some people say the game's going to be over very early.
I thought you were going to say some people say the game's going to be an anticlimax given all this other stuff that we've been talking about. But the way the NFL is marketed and the way you know, people pay as much attention to football as they do, I don't think that will be the case. I think there's every reason to think that the Patriots, despite all these dramatic rifts between ownership, coach, and quarterback, that they will prevail. They're a very good football team, and I don't think there's any reason to think that they won't carry on to the conference championship the next week.
All right. Well, we heard it here. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on WBUR Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Bill, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Deb.
We do have a final note now. President Trump and Norway's visiting prime minister spoke at the White House earlier this hour. President Trump held a press conference about this, and in response to reporters' questions, the president once again said there was absolutely no collusion between his campaign and Russia. We do have a clip of the president from the press conference that just wrapped up moments ago. Let's listen.
I've been in office now for 11 months. For 11 months, they've had this phony cloud over this administration, over our government, and it has hurt our government. It does hurt our government.
President Trump also said again at this press conference just moments ago that he will not sign an immigration bill from Congress that does not include his proposal for a border wall. Let's listen.
I really believe they're going to come up with a solution to the DACA problem, which has been going on for a long time, and maybe beyond that, immigration as a whole. But any solution has to include the wall, because without the wall, it all doesn't work.
That's President Trump at a press conference earlier today, just within the past hour. For more on the press conference and all the news of the day, stay tuned to All Things Considered, which gets underway in just a couple of minutes. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna and Allison Bruzek. We had help from Zoe Mitchell, Cassandra Sunt, Lily Tyson, and Anna Saldinger. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.